office and wait for Senor Willis's car that never came. She began to brood, and the more she brooded, the more afraid she became. This wasn't just bad luck. This was an ongoing catastrophe. And how long could they survive that? Candida was the best man in the world, loving and kind, and he'd never known the meaning of the word lazy in his life. But everything he did turned out wrong. There was no life for her here. No little house, no bathroom with its gleaming faucets and bright white commode like the bathroom in the Guatón's big astonishing mansion. It was time to give it up. Time to go back to Tepoztlan and beg her father to take her back. She had her daughter now, and her daughter was a North American, a citizen of Los Estados Unidos. And she could come back when she was grown and claim her birthright. But then how would anyone know? Didn't they have to record the birth in the village or the church? But what village? What church? Candido. What about the baby? She said one night, as they sat before the hearth he'd constructed of cement blocks, laying sticks on the fire while water boiled in the pot. It was raining, a soft, discontinuous patter on the plastic roof, and she was lying snug atop the sacks of grass seed, wrapped in the blanket. Candido had been gone all day, scouring the roadside for cans and bottles to redeem in the machine outside the Chinese store, and he'd come home with sugar, coffee, and rice. "What about her?" he said. "We have to register her birth with the priest. She was born here, but who's going to know that?" He was silent, squatting over his haunches, breaking up sticks to feed the fire. He'd managed to make the place comfortable for her. She had to give him that. The slats between the pallets had been stuffed with rags and newspaper for insulation, and with a fire, even on the coldest days, she was warm. And he'd got water for them, too, spending a whole night digging a trench up the hill and tapping into the development sprinkler system, cutting the pipe and running joined lengths of it all the way up to the little invisible house, and then he'd buried it and hidden his traces so well no one would ever suspect. "What priest?" he said finally. She shrugged. Socorro lay sleeping at her breast. "I don't know. The village priest." "What village?" "I want to go home. I hate this place. I hate it." Candido was silent a moment, his face like a withered fruit. "We could walk into Canoga Park again, if you think you're up to it," he said finally. "They must have a priest there. He would know what to do. At least he could baptize her." She dreaded the idea after her last experience, but just the mention of the name, Canoga Park, made her see the shops again, the girls on the street, the little restaurant that was like a cafe back at home. Somebody there would know what to do. Somebody would help. "It's awfully far," she said. He said nothing. He was staring into the fire, his lips pursed, hands clasped in his lap. "What did you do with the cord?" she said after a moment. "Cord? What cord?" "You know, the baby's cord. The umbilical." "I buried it, along with the rest. What do you think?" "I wanted that cord. For Chalma. I wanted to make a pilgrimage and hang it in the tree and pray to the Virgin to give Socorro a long and happy life." And she saw the tree in her mind, the great ancient ajuehuete tree beside the road, with the crowds of pilgrims around it and the vendors and the hundreds upon hundreds of dried birth cords hanging from the branches like confetti. Socorro would never know that tree. She'd never be blessed. America had to catch her breath to keep from sobbing with the hopelessness of it. "I hate it here," she whispered. "God, how I hate it." Candido didn't answer. He made coffee with sugar and condensed milk, and they drank it out of frijole cans, and then he cut up an onion, some chiles, and a tomato, and cooked the rice, and she wouldn't get up, wouldn't help him, even if he'd tried to force her. It rained the next day, too, all day. And when she went out to relieve herself and bury the baby's diaper, the earth was like glue. For all this time it had been powder, and now it was glue. She stood there in the rain, looking out over the misted canyon, the roofs of the houses, the barren scar of Candido's fire. And the rain smelled good, smelled of release and reprieve, smelled ever so faintly of home. She had to get away. Even if it meant bundling up Socorro and walking all the way back to the border, and if she starved along the way, then it was God's will. It was dark inside, dark as a hole in the ground. and when the rain slackened to a drizzle, she brought the baby outside for a breath of air. Sitting there high on the hillside, watching the clouds roll out over the canyon all the way to the sea and the cars creep like toys up the slick canyon road, she felt better. This was America, and it was a beautiful place, drier and hotter than Tepoztlan in the dry season and colder in the wet. But she felt that there was peace here, if only she could find it. Peace and prosperity, too. She looked down then into her daughter's face, and the baby was staring past her, staring up and away into a distance she couldn't possibly contain. And it was in that moment that America felt the naked, sharp claws of apprehension take hold of her. She passed a hand over her daughter's face, and her daughter didn't blink. She bent her own face to Socorro's and tugged at those dull black irises with her own, and they only stared as if there was a wall between them. And then the baby blinked and sneezed, and the eyes stared at nothing. Candido told her they were eating rabbit, but rabbit was hard to come by up here. Those other little four-legged beasts, the ones with the bells on their collars to warn away the birds, they were easier to catch. All you had to do was wait till midnight, slip over the wall and whisper, "Kitty, here, kitty." So they ate meat, even if it tasted stringy and sour, and they ate kibble and rice and whatever fruits and vegetables he dared to take. They had water, they had heat, they had a roof over their heads. But it was all a stopgap, a delaying action, a putting off of the inevitable. He'd stared so long and so hard at that strip of road out front of the post office waiting for the apparition of Señor Willis's Corvair that it wasn't a real place anymore, but a scene he devised in his brain. If he blinked, it wouldn't exist. There were no braceros there, not a one, and the word must have been out. Candido didn't dare show himself, and if he didn't show himself, how could he get work? And if he couldn't get work, no matter how many things he borrowed from the houses beyond the wall, or how many cans he collected in the bushes, sooner or later they would starve. If only he could call Señor Willis. But Señor Willis didn't have a phone. He could go back to Canoga Park, but there was no work there. He knew that already. And 100 men ready to kill for whatever work might turn up. A little money. That was all he needed. With a little money, he might think about going back to Tepoztlan, at least for the winter. His aunt might take them in, and he could always make charcoal. But America, he'd boasted to her, he'd promised her things. America would certainly leave him then, mewed up behind the gate at her father's house till she was a hag scrubbing the floors, and Socorro was married off to some chingado her old man owed money to. Candido took the risk. He waited till the rain began to crackle on the pavement and the hair hung wet in his eyes, and then he stepped out of the bushes, crossed the road, and stood beneath the overhang out front of the post office, stamping his feet and hugging his shoulders to keep the circulation going. Surely somebody would take pity on him and bring him home to work in a warm basement, putting up drywall or painting or cleaning out the trash. He waited, wet through and shivering, and every gringo who got out of his car and ducked into the post office gave him a look of unremitting hate. If they didn't know he'd started the fire personally, they all suspected it. And where there was once tolerance and human respect, where there was the idea of community and a labor exchange and people to support it, now there was only fear and resentment. They didn't want to hire him. They didn't want to see him warm. They didn't want to see him fed and clothed and with a place to sleep at night that was better than a ditch or a shack hidden in the weeds. They wanted to see him dead. Or no, they didn't want to see him at all. He waited there through the afternoon, and when he couldn't take the cold anymore, he went into the lobby of the post office, a public place, and a man in a blue uniform stepped from behind the counter and told him in Spanish that he had to leave. America was strange that night. He huddled next to her, trying to stop shivering, and she didn't mention going home, not once, though she'd driven him half mad with it for the past 2 weeks. Now it was the baby. That was all she could talk about. The baby needed to go to a clinic. The baby needed a doctor, a gringo doctor, to look at her. But was the baby sick, he wanted to know? She looked all right to him. No, America gasped. No, she's not sick. But we need to have a doctor check her out, just in case. And how will we get to this doctor? How will we pay? He was irritated, feeling harassed, squeezed dry. She didn't know. She didn't care, but the baby had to have a doctor. In the morning, Candido put a pot of rainwater on the grill to boil. He'd run a length of PVC pipe off the development sprinkler system, easiest thing in the world, what with the saw and the cement and all the elbows and connectors right there in the shed for the taking. But he didn't use it if he didn't have to. And he skidded down the muddy slope, keeping low to the cover, and went back to the post office. It was overcast, with a cold breeze coming down out of the mountains, but the rain had tapered off at dawn, and that was a relief. Candido leaned against the brick front of the building, watching the earthworms crawl up out of the saturated earth to die on the pavement, and trying his best to look eager and non-threatening to the gringos and gringas who hurried in and out of the door with Christmas packages in their arms. He could hear the creek where it cut into the bank out back of the post office before whipping round to pass under the bridge and plunge into the cut of the gorge. It was a sinister sound, a hiss that rose to a roar and fell back again as a crippled tree or boulder slammed along the bed of the stream and hung up on some hidden obstruction. They would have been flooded out if they were still camped below, flushed down the canyon like waste in a toilet, battered against the rocks and washed out to sea for the crabs to feed on. He thought about that, watching the earthworms wriggling on the pavement and the postal patrons stepping delicately through the puddles as if dirtying their shoes was the worst tragedy that could befall them. And he wondered if the fire hadn't been a blessing in disguise. Maybe there was a providence looking out for him after all. The thought cheered him. He began to smile at the people going in and out, combing his mustache down with his fingers and showing his teeth. "Work?" he said to one woman, riding up off her heels like a gymnast, but she turned away as if he were invisible, as if it were the wind talking to her. But he kept on, his smile growing increasingly desperate, until the man in the blue uniform, the same one as yesterday, a gabacho with a ponytail and turquoise eyes, came out and told him in textbook Spanish that he was going to have to leave if he didn't have business at the post office. Candido shrugged his shoulders, grinning still. He couldn't help it. It was like a reflex. "I'm sorry if I'm bothering anybody," he said, relieved to be explaining himself, relieved to be talking in his own language, and thinking that maybe this was the break he was looking for, that maybe this man would be another Señor Willis. "But I need work, to feed my wife and baby, and I was wondering if you knew of anything around here." The man looked at him then, really looked at him, but all he said was, "This isn't a good place for you to be." Dispirited, Candido crossed the road and shambled over the bridge in the direction of the Chinese market and the lumberyard beyond it. He'd hardly even noticed the bridge before. It was just a section of the road suspended over the dead brush of the stream bed. But now its function was revealed to him as the churning yellow water pounded at its concrete abutments and the boulders slammed into it with a rumble that was like the grinding of the earth's molars. All through the summer and fall there had been no water, and now suddenly there was too much. Candido stood for a while outside the Chinese store, though he was nervous about that, and sure enough, the old Chinaman, the one with the goggle glasses and the suspenders to hold the pants up over his skinny hips, came out to shoo him away in his weird up-and-down language. But Candido wouldn't give up, and so he stood just down the street from the lumberyard, hoping some contractor picking up materials might see him there and give him work. It wasn't a propitious place, even in the best of times, and Candido had never seen a single bracero hunkered over his heels here. Rumor had it that the lumberyard boss would call the cops the minute he saw a Mexican in the lot. Candido stood there for 2 hours, trying to attract the attention of every pickup that pulled into the lumberyard, so desperate now he didn't care if La Migra picked him up or not. But no one gave him even so much as a glance. His feet hurt, and his stomach rumbled. He was cold. It must have been about 4:30 when he finally gave it up and started back along the road looking for cans to redeem and thinking he would watch for his chance to stick his head in the dumpster out back of the Paisano's market. He had to bring something back with him, anything. Every once in a while they would throw out a bag of onions with nothing worse than a few black spots on them or potatoes that had sprouted eyes. You never knew. He was keeping his head down and watching his feet, thinking maybe there'd be some meat that wouldn't be so bad if you boiled it long enough, or some bones and fat from the beef they'd trimmed out, when a car swerved in across the shoulder just ahead of him. He froze, thinking of the accident all over again, wet roads, Norte Americanos in a hurry, always in a hurry, and the next car blared its horn in a shrill mechanical curse because the rear end of the first car, the one right there on the shoulder, was sticking out into the roadway, and all the endless line of cars coming up the hill with their wipers clapping and headlights glaring had to break the flow to swerve around it. But now the door was swinging open, and another horn blared, and Candido was poisoned with déjà vu. This inescapable white, the fiery red brake lights and the yellow blinker, it was all so familiar. Before he had a chance to react, there he was, the pelirrojo who'd run him down all those months ago and then sent his gangling, ugly pelirrojo of a son down into the canyon to harass and torment him. And the look on his face was pure malice. "You," he shouted, "you stay right there."
7.
"You," Delaney shouted, "you stay right there." He'd been coming up the road from the nursery on the coast highway, the trunk crammed with bags of ammonium sulfate and fescue seed, his view out the back partially obscured by a pair of areca palms for the front hallway. When he spotted the hunched shoulders, the weather-bleached khaki shirt, and the pale soles of the Mexican's dark feet working against the straps of his sandals, he slowed automatically, without thinking. Could this be the man? Was this him? And then he jerked the wheel and felt the rear tires yaw away from him, even as the driver behind him hit the horn, and he was up on the shoulder, spewing gravel, his rear end sticking out on the road. Delaney didn't care. He didn't care about the hazard, didn't care about the other drivers of the wet road or his insurance rates. All he cared about was this Mexican, this man who'd invaded his life like some unshakable parasite, like a disease. It was here, almost at the very spot that he'd flung himself under the wheels of the car. Everything come full circle. And this time, Delaney wasn't going to let him off. This time he had proof, photographic proof. "You stay right there," Delaney roared. And he punched 911 into the car phone Kyra had given him as an early Christmas present. The Mexican stood there dumbfounded, leaner and harder-looking than Delaney remembered him, the eyes black and startled, the thick brush of the mustache making a wound of his mouth.
"Hello?" Delaney bawled into the receiver. "My name is Delaney Mossbacher, and I want to report a crime in progress, or no, an apprehension of a suspect on Topanga Canyon Road near Topanga Village, just south of..."
But before he could finish, the suspect had begun to move. The Mexican looked at Delaney, looked at the telephone in his hand, and then he just stepped right out into the traffic like a sleepwalker. Delaney watched in shock as the high blue surging apparition of a pickup cab with a woman's face frozen behind the windshield framed the Mexican's spindly legs and humped over torso in a portrait of unquenchable momentum, and then, at the last possible moment, veered away in a screeching, rattling, fishtailing blur that hit the guardrail and ricocheted into the back end of his Acura Vigor GS. His new milk-white Acura Vigor GS with the tan leather upholstery and only 3,816 miles on the odometer, where it finally came to rest in all its trembling, wide-bodied authority. And the Mexican? He was unscathed, jogging up the opposite side of the road while horns blared and bumpers kissed all the way up and down the frantically braking string of cars. It was the commuter's nightmare. It was Delaney's nightmare.
"Hello? Hello, are you there?" cried a voice through the speaker of the phone.
Delaney didn't call Kyra. He didn't call Jack. He didn't bother with Kenny Grissom or the body shop or even his insurer. As the rain started up again, a blanketing drizzle that seeped into his every pore, he stood at the side of the road and exchanged information with the woman in the pickup. She was in a rage, trembling all over, showing her teeth like a cornered rodent and stamping her feet in the mud.
"What's wrong with you?" she demanded. "Are you out of your mind stopping like that with your back end sticking halfway out across the road? And what's with your friend? Is he drunk or something? Just strolling right out in front of me without even turning his head? You're both drunk. You've got to be. And believe me, you're in trouble, mister, and I'm going to demand the cops give you a breath test right here and now."
The policeman who showed up 20 minutes later was grim and harried. He questioned Delaney and the woman separately about the details of the accident, and Delaney tried to tell him about the Mexican, but the cop wasn't interested.
"I'm telling you, it was this Mexican. He's crazy. He throws himself in front of cars to try and collect on the insurance. He's the one, and I've got a photograph. I caught him out front of a Royal Blanco, that's where I live, where we've all had that trouble with graffiti lately."
They were seated in the patrol car, Delaney in the passenger seat, the cop bent over his pad, laboriously writing out his report in a jagged left-handed script. The radio sputtered and crackled. Rain spilled across the windshield in sheets, drummed on the roof, really coming down now. There were accidents on the coast highway, Malibu Canyon Road, 101, the dispatcher's voice numb with the monotony of disaster.
Your vehicle was obstructing the road, the cop said finally, and that was all. Delaney sat in his car till the tow truck arrived. He showed the driver his AAA card and then refused a ride home. I'm going to walk, he said. It's only a mile and a half. The driver studied him a moment, then handed him a receipt and pulled the door closed. The rain had slackened, but Delaney was already wet through to the skin, the Gore-Tex jacket clinging to his shoulders like a sodden pelt, the hair stamped to his forehead and dancing round his ears in a lank red fringe. Suit yourself, the man said through the crack of the window. And then Delaney was walking up the shoulder of the road as the pale shell of his car faded away into the mist ahead of him. He was walking, but this time he wasn't merely walking to get somewhere, as on the torrid, high-ceilinged summer morning when his first car was stolen. This time he had a purpose. This time. As he waited for a break in the traffic and dashed across the road, this time he was following a set of footprints up the muddy shoulder, very distinctive prints, unmistakable, cut in the rippled pattern of a tire tread. Kyra could barely see the road. The rain had come up suddenly, closing off her view like a curtain dropping at the end of a play, and she had no choice but to hit her emergency flasher and pull off onto the shoulder to wait it out. She took advantage of the delay to thumb through her Thomas guide and compare the map with the directions Delaney had scrawled on the notepad by the telephone. It was just past 4, and she'd taken the afternoon off to do some Christmas shopping. Business was slow, dead in the water, actually, and for as long as she could remember, she'd been meaning to start making a little more time for her family and for herself, too. And she'd volunteered to pick up Jordan at his friend's house. She didn't know the boy. He was a friend from school, and since Delaney had dropped Jordan off, she didn't know the house either, or the street, which she was having trouble finding. If she'd smoked, she would have lit a cigarette, but she didn't smoke. So she put in a relaxation tape and listened to the artificial waves soughing through the speakers while the rain, palpable and real, sizzled on the pavement and rapped like a medium's knuckles at the roof of the car. It gave her a cozy feeling, a feeling of being impervious to the elements, sealed in and secure. And she looked at the map and listened to her tape and realized that for the first time and as long as she could remember, she was in no hurry to get anywhere. She'd been driving herself too hard for too long, and for what? Even before the DeRoss place went up, she'd begun to have days when she just couldn't seem to muster the enthusiasm to stuff envelopes with potholders or write up ads with the same tired old stock adjectives and banal abbreviations. Charming Montanito rustic contempt, Las Virgenes schools, 2-ache horse prop, 6BR, 4.5BA, family room, pool, price to sell— or even show Mr. and Mrs. Nobody through the eternal hallways of all the eternal houses they had neither the taste nor the money to buy, and then arranging creative financing and holding their hands through a 60-day escrow that was as likely as not to fall out. It was about as exciting as going to the toilet. The deal-making, slipping the needle in and pulling it out so quickly and painlessly they didn't even know they'd been pricked. That still got her pulse pounding, and so did beating everybody else out for a listing, especially a to-kill-for one like the DeRoss place. But the thrills were all too few and far between. Ah, there was the problem. She didn't know this part of Agoura as well as she should have, and she confused Foothill Place with Foothill Drive. She was on Foothill Drive now, and there it was, Kamado Canyon Road in the upper left-hand corner of the map. She'd never heard of it before. It must be one of those new streets that jog up and down the grassy hills like roller coasters. Everything was new out here, a burgeoning, bustling, mini-mall building testimonial to white flight, the megalopolis encroaching on the countryside. 10 years ago, this was rural. 10 years before that, you couldn't find it on the map. Kyra was sure there must be some really primo properties up here, older houses, estates, ranches the developers hadn't got to yet. The schools were good, property values holding their own, maybe even rising a bit, and it was just a hop, skip, and jump from Woodland Hills, Malibu, and Calabasas. She should look into it. She really should. The rain fell off as abruptly as it had begun, gray banks of drizzle bellying up to the hills like inverted clouds, and Kyra started up the engine, looked over her shoulder, and wheeled out onto the blacktop road. She came to a T and bore left, past a tract of single-family homes and up into the undulating hills where the houses were farther apart. Nothing special, but they had property, an acre or more, it looked like. And she saw half a dozen blonde-haired children going up and down a long drive, and a flock of sheep patched into a greening hillside. The trees seemed to stand up a bit straighter here, their leaves washed clean of 6 months' accumulation of dust, particulates, and hydrocarbons and whatever else the air held in suspension. It was pretty country, real estate, and it made her feel good. The road forked again and became narrower, a remnant of the cart path that must once have been here, ranchers hauling hay or whatever to feed their cattle, Model Ts and A's digging narrow ruts along the inside shoulders of the switchbacks, wood stoves and candlelight, chickens running free. Kyra didn't know what it was, but she was swept up in a vision of a time before this one, composed in equal parts of Saturday Evening Post covers, Lassie reruns, and nostalgia for what she'd never known. These people really lived in the middle of nowhere. Arroyo Blanco was like Pershing Square compared to this. It was amazing. She had no idea there was so much open space out here, and not 5 miles from 101, she bet, and no more than 12 or 15 from the city limits, if that. Was it still in L.A. County, she wondered, or had she crossed the line? It was then, wondering and relaxed, enjoying the day, the scenery, the season, that she spotted the inconspicuous little sign at the head of a blacktop drive tucked away in a grove of eucalyptus just past the Kamado Canyon turnoff. For sale by owner. She drove right past it, parting the veil of blue-gray mist that shrouded the road, but then she checked herself, pulled over onto the shoulder, and made a U-turn that took her back to the driveway. The sign wasn't very revealing. For sale by owner was all it said. And then there was a phone number beneath it. Was there a house in there? A ranch? An estate? Judging from the size of the eucalyptus, huge, pale, shedding old relics with mounds of sloughed bark at their feet, the place hadn't been thrown together yesterday. But it was probably nothing. Probably a paint-blistered old chicken shack with a bunch of rusted-out cars in the yard, or a trailer. She sat there opposite the drive in her idling car, the window rolled down, the sweet fresh breath of the rain in her face, watching the silver leaves of the eucalyptus dissolve into the mist and then reappear again. It was 4:40. She told the boy's mother, Karen, or was it Aaron, that she'd be by to pick up Jordan at 5, but still she didn't feel any compulsion. It was Christmas, or almost Christmas, and it was raining. And besides, the woman, Karen or Aaron, had sounded sweet on the phone, and she'd said there was no problem. Kyra could come whenever she wanted. The boys were playing so nicely together. And you never knew what was at the end of a drive if you didn't take the time to find out. The sign was an invitation, wasn't it? Of course it was. Real estate. She pushed in the trip odometer, flicked on the turn signal, took a precautionary look over her shoulder, and started up the drive. She left the window open to enjoy the wet, fecund, ever-so-faintly mentholated smell of the eucalyptus buttons crushed on the pavement, and let her eyes record the details. Trees and more trees, a whole deep, brooding forest of eucalyptus, and birds calling from every branch. Half a mile in, she crossed a fieldstone bridge over a brook swollen with runoff from the storm, came round a long, sweeping bend, and caught sight of the house. She was so surprised she stopped right there, 100 yards from the place, and just gaped at it. All the way out here, on what must have been 10 acres minimum, stood a 3-story stone and plaster mansion that could have been lifted right out of Beverly Hills, or better yet, a village in the south of France. The style was French eclectic, simple, understated, with a tony elegance that made the late de Ross place seem fussy, even garish by comparison. From the hipped roof with its flared eaves to the stone quoins accenting windows and doors and the thick, sturdy plaster walls painted in the exact pale cinnamon shade of the eucalyptus trunks and festooned with grapevines gone blood-red with the season, the place was a revelation. The grounds, too. The plantings were rustic but well cared for and well thought out. There was a circular drive out front that swept round a pond with a pair of swans streaming across it, and the pond was set off by casual groupings of birch and Japanese maple. For sale, by owner. She'd have to play this one carefully, very carefully. Kyra let the car roll forward as if it had a mind of its own. Then she leaned into the arc of the drive, swung round front, and parked. She spent half a minute with her compact, ran both hands through her hair, and went up the steps. A man about 50 in a plaid flannel shirt and tan slacks answered the door. Behind him, already trying on a smile, was the wife, stationed behind a mahogany parlor table in a long white entrance hall. "You must be here to see the house," the man said. Kyra never hesitated.
She was thinking 2 mil easy, maybe more, depending on the acreage, and even as she was totting up her commission on that 60,000 and wondering why she should have to share it with Mike Bender. She was thinking about the adjoining properties and who owned them and whether this place couldn't be the anchor for a very select private community of high-end houses, and that's where the money was, in developing, not selling, developing. Yes, she said, giving them the full benefit of her face and figure and her nonpareil closer's smile. Yes, I am. There were places where the spoor was interrupted, the footprints erased by the force of the downpour that had swept over the hills while Delaney was sitting in the police cruiser, wasting his breath. That was all right. He knew which direction his quarry had taken, and all he had to do was keep moving up the shoulder till the prints became discernible again. And he didn't need much. The scuff of a toe in the gravel or the cup of a heel slowly filling with dirty yellow water. If he could track a fox that had slipped its radio collar and doubled back through a running stream for 300 yards before climbing up into the lower branches of a sycamore, then he was more than capable of tracking this clumsy Mexican all the way to hell and back. And that was exactly what he was going to do, track him down if it took all night. It was getting dark, black dark, by the time he reached Arroyo Blanco Drive. And when he saw by the lights of a passing car that the prince turned left into the road, he wasn't surprised, not really. It explained a lot of things, the graffiti, the photo, all the little incidentals that had turned up missing throughout the community, the plastic sheeting, the dog dishes, the kibble. The fire had flushed him out, and now the drunken moron was camped up here, spraying his graffiti, stealing kibble, shitting in a ditch. And then it came to him. What if he was the one who'd started the fire? What if the wetback with the hat was innocent all along, and that's why the police couldn't hold him? This one had been camping down there somewhere, hadn't he? Delaney saw the glint of the shopping cart all over again, and the trail plunging down into the canyon, and the Mexican there in the weeds, broken and bleeding. And he couldn't help thinking it would have been better for everyone concerned if he'd just crawled off into the bushes and died. But now it was dark, and he was going to have to get a flashlight if he was going to go on with this. And he was. He was determined to go on with it, no matter what, right to the end. He was almost at the gate when a car pulled over and the rain-bleared image of Jim Shirley's face appeared in the window on the driver's side. It was raining again, white pinpricks that jumped off the blacktop in the wash of the car's headlights. The window cranked halfway down and Jim Shirley's skin glowed green and red under the blinking Christmas lights. "What in hell are you doing out in the rain, Delaney? Looking for horned toads? Come on, I'll give you a lift." Delaney crossed to the car and stood hunched by the window, but he didn't say, "Hi, Jim, hell of a night, and how are you doing, or thanks, or no thanks." "You wouldn't have a flashlight I could borrow, would you?" he asked, the rain terracing his cheeks and dripping steadily from the tip of his nose. Green and red, the colors settled into the big bloated face above the black band of the beard. "No, afraid not," Jim Shirley said. "Used to keep one in the car, but the batteries went dead, and then my wife was going to replace them, and that's the last I saw of it." "Why? You lose something?" "No, that's all right," Delaney murmured, backing away now. "Thanks." He watched Jim Shirley drive through the gate and on up into the development, and then he turned, and in the haunted light of the red and green blinking bulbs, discovered the fresh outrage of the wall, the mocking black hieroglyphs staring back at him right there, as raw as the paint that was already smearing in the rain, right there under the nose of the guard and the blinking lights and everything else. His car was wrecked. His dogs were gone. He went right up to the wall and pressed a finger to the paint, and the finger came back wet and black, stained black. This was the signal. This was it. The declaration of war, the knife thrown in the dirt. First the car, now this. Delaney thought of the cameras then, of the evidence, and he tugged the cord at his feet so the flash would locate him. Only one camera flashed, the near one. The other had been smashed. He couldn't see if any of the pictures had been exposed. The light was too dim, and so he tucked the functional camera under his jacket and worked his way along the wall to the gate. When he rapped on the glass of the guard's cubicle, the guard, a lugubrious, long-nosed kid with a croaking voice and the faintest blonde beginnings of a mustache, jumped as if he'd been goosed with a cattle prod, and then Delaney was in the booth with him, and the kid was saying, "Jesus, Mr. Mossbacher, you really scared me. What's the matter? Is anything wrong?" It was close, steaming. Room for one, and now there were two.
A red-and-white striped box of fried chicken sat beside a paperback on the control panel, the cover of the paperback decorated with the over-muscled figure of a sword-wielding barbarian and his two bare-breasted female companions.
"Your car break down?" the kid croaked.
Delaney pulled out the camera and saw that six pictures had been exposed, six indisputable pieces of incriminating evidence, and he felt as if he just hit a home run to win the game. The kid was watching him, his eyes like little glittering rivets supporting the weight of that nose, something sallow and liverish in his skin. They were 6 inches apart, their shoulders filling the booth.
"No," Delaney said, giving him a grin that in retrospect must have seemed about 3/4 deranged. "Everything's okay, just fine, perfect."
And then he was ducking back out into the rain and jogging up the street toward his house, thinking of the photos, yes, thinking of the wrecked car and the slap in the face of the wall, but thinking above all of the gun in the garage, the Smith & Wesson stainless steel .38 special Jack had talked him into buying for home protection. He'd never wanted the thing. He hated guns. He'd never hunted, never killed anything in his life, nor did he ever want to. Rednecks had guns, criminals, vigilantes, the cretinous, trigger-happy minions of the NRA who needed assault rifles to hunt deer and thought that the natural world existed only as a vast and ever-shifting target. But he'd bought it. With Jack. They'd had a drink after tennis one afternoon at a sushi bar in Tarzana. It must have been 6 months ago now. Jack had just introduced Delaney to Onigiroshi on the rocks, and the conversation had turned to the sad and parlous state of the world as represented in the newspaper, when Jack swung round in his seat and said, "Knowing you, I'll bet you're completely naked."
"Naked? What do you mean?"
"Home protection." Delaney watched Jack lift a sliver of Maguro to his lips.
"I bet the best you can do is maybe a Louisville Slugger, am I right?"
"You mean a gun?"
"Absolutely," Jack said, chewing, and then he reached for the glass of sake to wash it down. "It's an angry, fragmented society out there, Delaney, and I'm not only talking about your native haves and have-nots, but the torrents of humanity surging in from China and Bangladesh and Colombia with no shoes, no skills, and nothing to eat. They want what you've got, my friend, and do you really think they're going to come knocking at the door and ask politely for it? Look, it boils down to this. No matter what you think about guns, would you rather be the killer or the killee?"
Jack had picked up the check, and from there they'd gone to Grantham's Gun Mart in Van Nuys, and it wasn't at all what Delaney had expected. There were no escaped convicts or Hell's Angels sifting through bins of hollow-point bullets, no swaggering bear hunters or palpitating accountants running up and down the aisles with their tails between their legs. The place was wide open, brightly lit, the wares laid out on display as if Grantham's was dealing in fine jewelry or perfume or Rolex watches. Nothing was furtive, nobody was embarrassed. And the clientele, so far as Delaney could see, consisted of average ordinary citizens in shorts and college sweatshirts, business suits and dresses, shopping for the tools of murder as casually as they might have shopped for rat traps or gopher pellets at the hardware store. The woman behind the counter, Samantha Grantham herself, looked like a retired first-grade teacher, gray hair in a bun, silver-framed glasses, her fingers fat and elegant atop the display case. She sold Delaney the same model handgun she carried in her purse, the one she'd used to scare off the would-be muggers in the parking lot at the Fallbrook Mall after the late movie. And she sold him a lightweight Bianchi clipped-on holster made of nylon with a Velcro strap that fit right down inside the waistband of his pants as comfortably as a second pocket. When he got home, he felt ashamed of himself, felt as if he'd lost all hope, and he'd locked the thing away in a chest in the garage and forgotten all about it. Till now. Now he came in the front door, water puddling on the carpet, fished the key out of the desk drawer in his office and went directly out to the garage. The chest was made of steel, fireproof, the size of 2 reams of paper, stacked. There was dust on it. He fit the key in the lock, flipped back the lid, and there it was, the gun he'd forgotten all about. It glowed in his hand, flashing light under the naked bulb that dangled from the ceiling, and the rain crashed at the roof. His mouth was dry. He was breathing hard. He inserted the bullets in the slot so ingeniously designed to receive them, each one sliding in with a precise and lethal click, and he knew he would never use the thing, never fire it, never. But he was going to draw it out of the holster in all its deadly flashing beauty and hold it there over that vandalizing alien black-eyed jack-in-the-box till the police came and put him away where he belonged. Delaney tucked the gun into his holster and tucked the holster into his pants, and then a spasm passed through him. He was freezing, shivering so hard he could barely reach a hand to the light switch. He was going to have to change. That was the first thing. And where was Kyra? Shouldn't she be home by now? And then the film, and maybe something to eat. The lights had been out at Jack and Zelda's as he passed by on the street, but he knew where they kept the spare key under the third flower pot on the right, just outside the back door, and he was sure they wouldn't mind if he just slipped in for a minute and used the dark room. He had to have those photos, had to catch the jerk with the spray can in his hand, catch him in the act. The other picture, the first one, was something, but it wasn't conclusive. They could always say in court that it didn't prove a thing except that the suspect was out there on public property, where he had every right to be, and who was going to say he wasn't on his way to the gate to visit friends in Arroyo Blanco, or that he wasn't there looking for work, or delivering flyers. But these new photos, these six, Delaney would have them printed and blown up and lying right there on the counter in the kitchen when the police came in. But first, his clothes. His body was seized with an involuntary tremor, then another, and he sneezed twice as he set the gun down on the bed and kicked off his shoes. He would take a hot shower to warm up, that's what he would do. Then he'd check the message machine, Kyra must have taken Jordan out for a pizza, and then he'd sit down and have something for himself, a can of soup, anything. There was no hurry. He knew now where to find the bastard, up there, up in the chaparral, within sight of the wall. And he'd have to have a fire on a night like this, and the fire would give him away. It would be the last fire he'd ever start, around here at least. While the soup was heating in the microwave, Delaney pulled a clean pair of jeans out of the closet, dug down and back for his High Sierra lightweight hiking boots with the half-inch tread, laid out a pair of insulated socks, a sweater, and his rain gear on the bed. The shower had warmed him, but he was still trembling, and he realized it wasn't the cold affecting him, but adrenaline, pure adrenaline. He was too keyed up to do much more than blow on the soup, Campbell's chunky vegetable, and then he was in the hallway, standing before the full-length mirror and watching himself tuck the gun into his pants and pull it out again while listening to the messages on the machine. Kyra was going to be late, just as he'd thought. She'd got involved with some house in Agoura, of all places, and she was late picking up Jordan and thought she'd maybe just take him out for Chinese and then to the card shop. He was collecting X-Men cards now. Delaney looked up, dropped the film in his pocket, and stepped back out into the rain. It was coming down hard. Pinon was like a stream bed, nothing moving but the water, and he could hear boulders slamming around in the culverts high up on the hill where they were meant to deflect runoff and debris from the development. Delaney wondered about that, and he stood there in the rain a long moment, listening for the roar of the mountain giving way. What with erosion in the burn area and all this rain, anything could happen. They were vulnerable. These were the classic mudslide conditions, nothing to hold the soil in thanks to the match-happy Mexican up there. But then there really wasn't much he could do about it. If the culverts overflowed, the wall would repel whatever came down. It wasn't as if he and his neighbors would have to be out there sandbagging or anything. He was concerned, of course he was concerned. He was concerned about everything. And if the weather gods would grant him a wish, he'd cut this back to a nice, safe, gently soaking drizzle. But at least the way it was coming down now, that bastard up there would be pinned down in whatever kind of hovel he'd been able to throw together, and that would make him all the easier to find. At the Cherry Stones, Delaney found the key under the pot with no problem, and he hung his poncho on the inside of the doorknob in the kitchen so as not to dribble water all over the tile. He fumbled for the light switch, the gun pressing at his groin like a hard, hot hand, like something that had come alive, and his heart slammed at his ribs and thudded in his ears. The light suddenly exploded in the room, and Zelda's cat, a huge Manx that was all but indistinguishable from a bobcat, sprang from the chair and shot down the hallway. Delaney felt like a thief. But then he was in the dark room, the film in the tank, and that calmed him. That was all right. "Any time," Jack had said, "any time you want." Delaney was so sure of what he was going to get this time, he barely registered the reversed images on the negatives. There was something there, shadowy figures, a blur of criminal activity. And he cut the curling strip of film and let it drop to the floor, printing up the first six frames on a contact sheet. When it was ready, he slid the paper into the developer and received his second photographic jolt of the week. This was no Mexican blinking scared and open-faced into the lens on a pair of towering legs anchored by glistening leather high-tops. No Mexican with the spray can plainly visible in his big white fist. No Mexican with hair that shade or cut. It was Jack Jr. Jack Jr. and an accomplice Delaney didn't recognize, and there they were, replicated 6 times on a sheet of contact paper, brought to life, caught in the act. It was as complete a surprise as Delaney had ever had, and it almost stopped him. Almost. He pushed himself up from the counter, and in a slow, methodical way he cleaned up, draining the trays, rinsing them, and setting them back on the shelf where Jack kept them. Then he dropped the negatives on the contact sheet, and balled the whole thing up in a wad and buried it deep in the trash. That Mexican was guilty. Sure he was. Guilty of so much more than this. He was camping up there, wasn't he? He'd wrecked Delaney's car, stolen kibble and plastic sheeting. And who knew but that he hadn't set that fire himself? The night was black, utterly, impenetrably black. But Delaney didn't want to use his flashlight. There was too much risk of giving himself away. As soon as he dropped down on the far side of the wall, the faint light of the development's porch lights and Christmas displays was snuffed out, and the night and the rain were all. The smell was raw and rich at the same time, an amalgam of smells, a whole mountainside risen from the dead. The boulders echoed in the steel-lined culverts, groaning like thunder, and everywhere the sound of running water. Every least crack in the soil was a fissure, and every fissure a channel, and every channel a stream. Delaney felt it washing round his ankles. His eyes, ever so gradually, began to adjust to the light. He started straight up along the backbone of the slope the coyote had ascended with Sacheverell in its jaws, and there was nothing under his feet. Where the white dust and the red grains of the anthills had lain thick on the dehydrated earth, there was now an invisible, infinitely elastic net of mud. Delaney's feet slipped out from under him despite the money-back guarantee of the boots, and he was down on his hands and knees before he'd gone 20 steps. Rain whipped his face. The chaparral disintegrated under the frantic grasp of his fingers. He kept going, foot by foot, seeking the level patches where he could rise to his feet and reconnoiter before he slipped again and went back to all fours. Time meant nothing. The universe was reduced to the square foot of broken sky over his head and the mud beneath his hands. He was out in it, right in the thick of it, as near to the cold, black, working heart of the world as he could get. And all the while he was thinking, "I've got him now, the son of a bitch, the jack-in-the-box, the firebug!" And the exhilaration that took hold of him was like a drug, and the drug shut out all reason. He never gave a thought to what he was going to do with the Mexican once he caught him. That didn't matter. None of it mattered. All that mattered was this, was finding him, rooting him out of his burrow and counting his teeth and his toes and the hairs on his head and noting it all down for the record. Delaney had been here before, been here 100 times stalking 100 different creatures. He was a pilgrim, after all. His senses were keen. There was no escaping him. And then, just as he knew he would, he caught the first faint reductive whiff of it. Wood smoke. Delaney touched the gun then, touched it where it lay tight against his groin, and let his nose guide him. 8. "You look like you just saw a ghost." Candido was feeding sticks into the fire, trying to warm himself, and he didn't answer. A moment ago he'd called out to her in the dark and the streaming rain so as not to startle her. "It's me, mi vida." And then he'd crawled through the dripping flap of rug they'd hung across the entrance, bringing the wet with him. He kicked the huaraches off outside, but his feet were balls of mud all the way up to his ankles, and his shirt and pants were dark with rain and pressed to his skin. He didn't have a jacket or a hat. America was about to say, "Candido, mi amor, you need to rinse your feet out the door. This place is bad enough as it is. It's leaking in the corner, and that smell of mold or rot or whatever it is driving me crazy." But she took another look at his face and changed her mind. He didn't have anything with him either, and that was strange. He always brought something back, a scrap of cloth she could make into a dress for the baby, a package of tortillas or rice or sometimes a candy bar. Tonight there was nothing, only that face. "Is there something wrong?" she said. He pulled his muddy feet up beneath him in that little space that was like a packing crate, the whole place hardly bigger than the king-size beds the gringos slept in. And she saw how thin and worn he'd become, and she felt she was going to cry. She couldn't hold it back, and it sounded like the whimper of a dog in her own ears. She was crying, sucking the sounds in before they could escape her, the rain drilling the green plastic roof and trickling down the clear plastic sheeting Candido had dug up somewhere to protect the walls, and still he didn't answer her. She watched a shiver pass through him, and then another. "I wish it was only a ghost," he said after a while, and he reached for the aluminum dish of cocido where it sat on the shelf he'd built in the corner to hold their poor stock of groceries. She watched him put the dish on the grill, poke up the fire, and lay a few sticks of the bigger wood in under it. Camping. How she hated camping. "It was that gabacho," he said. "The one with the red hair who hit me with his car. He scares me. He's like a madman. If he were back at home, back in the village, they'd take him to the city in a straitjacket and lock him up in the asylum." Her voice was hushed. The rain pounded at the door. "What happened? What do you think?" He curled his lip, and the sheen of the fire made his face come back to life. "I was walking along the road, minding my own business, and this was the worst day yet. Nothing, not a chance of work. And suddenly, there's this car coming up behind me, and I swear to Christ on his cross, the lunatic tried to hit me again. It was inches. He missed me by inches." She could smell the cocido now. There was meat in it, something he'd trapped, and potatoes and chiles and a good strong broth. She couldn't tell him now, couldn't tell him yet, though she'd been working up her nerve all day. Socorro had to have a doctor right away. She had to. But when he'd finished eating and warmed himself, then, it would have to be then. Candido's voice was low with wonder. "Then he got out of the car and came after me. And with one of those telephones in his hand, the wireless ones. And I think he was calling the police. But I wasn't going to wait around to find out. You can bet your life on that." "But what is it? What did I ever do to him? He can't know about the fire, can he? And that was an accident, God knows." "Maybe he tried to hit you the first time, too. Maybe he's a racist. Maybe he's a pig. Maybe he hates us because we're Mexican." "I can't believe it. How could anybody be that vicious? He gave me $20, remember?" $20, she spat, and she jerked her head so violently she woke the baby. "And he sent his son down into the canyon to abuse us, didn't he?" Later, after Candido had cleaned up the last of the cocido with three hot tortillas and his shirt had dried and the mud that had caked on his feet crumbled and fell through the slats of the floor, she steeled herself and came back to the question of Socorro and the doctor. "There's something wrong with her," America said, and a volley of wind-driven rain played off the plastic sheeting like spent ammunition. "It's her eyes. I'm afraid... But she couldn't go on. "What do you mean, her eyes?" Candido didn't need this. He didn't need another worry. "There's nothing wrong with her eyes," he said. And as if to prove it, he took the baby from her, and Socorro kicked out her arms in reflex and gave a harsh, rasping cry. He looked into her face a moment. Not too hard. He was afraid to look too hard. And then he glanced at America and said, "You're crazy. She's beautiful. She's perfect. What more do you want?" Socorro passed between them again, soft and fragile, and wrapped up in her towel. But for all that, Candido handled her as if she were a bundle of sticks, a loaf of bread, just another object. She can't see me, Candido. She can't see anything, and I'm afraid." Thunder struck his face. The rain screamed. "You're crazy." "No." And she could barely get the words out. "No, I'm not. We need the doctor. Maybe he can do something. Maybe." "You don't know, Candido. You don't know anything, and you don't want to." She was angry now, all of it pouring out of her, all the pain and worry and fear of the past few days, weeks, months. "It was my pee. My pee burned. That's what did it, because of..." She couldn't look him in the eye, the fire flickering, the lamp making a death mask of his face. "Because of those men." It was the worst wound she could have given him. But he had to understand, and there was no recrimination in it. What's done is done. But she never heard his response. Because at that moment, something fell against the side of the shack, something considerable, something animate. And then the flap was wrenched from the doorway and flung away into the night, and there was a face there, peering in.
a gabacho face, as startling and unexpected and horrible as any face leaping out of a dark corner on the Day of the Dead, and the shock of that was nothing, because there was a hand attached to that face, and the hand held a gun. Delaney found the shack, and his fingers told him it was made of stolen pallets and slats stripped from the chaparral and the roof that had turned up missing from Bill Vogel's greenhouse. There was light inside, from the fire and maybe a lantern, and it guided him, though the mud was like oil on glass, and he lost his balance and gave himself away. He thought he heard voices, more than one. He was outraged. How many of them were there? How many? This couldn't go on anymore, this destruction of the environment, this trashing of the hills and creeks and the marshes and everything else. This was the end of it. He blundered into the stolen flap of rug that concealed the entrance, and he tore it aside with one hand because the other hand, his right hand, somehow held the gun now. And it was as if the gun were sentient and animate and had sprung out of the holster and into the grip of his own fingers all on its own. And that was when things got hazy. He'd been hearing the roar for a minute or two now, a sound like the wildest surf pounding against the ruggedest shore. But there was no shore here. There was nothing but... And then he felt himself lifted up from behind by some monstrous, uncontainable force, and he dropped the gun and clutched at the frame of the stooped-over door of that pathetic little shack, staring in amazement into the lamp-lit faces there. His Mexican, that was him at last, and a girl he'd never seen before. And was that an infant? And the shack was spilling over on its side and floating up on the heavy liquid swell behind him until it fell to pieces and the light was snuffed out and the faces were gone and Delaney was drawn so much closer to that cold, black, working heart of the world than he'd ever dreamed possible. And so, in the end, it all came tumbling down on Candido, his daughter's affliction, the pelirrojo with the gun, the very mountain itself. The light was flickering, the rain hissing like a box of serpents prodded with a stick. "She can't see, Candido. She can't see anything," America said, and in that moment he had a vision of his perfect, plump little daughter transmogrified into an old hag with a cane and a seeing-eye dog, and before he could assimilate the meaning of that in all its fearful permutations and banish it from his consciousness. There was this maniac with the gun threatening his life, and before he could even begin to deal with that, the mountain turned to pudding, to mush. The light failed and the shack fell to pieces. At first, he didn't know what was happening. Who would? But there was no resisting that force. He could have built his shack of tungsten steel with footings 100 feet deep, and the result would have been the same. The mountain was going somewhere, and he was going with it. He didn't even have time to curse or flinch or wonder about his fate. All he could do was snatch America and his poor blind baby to him and hold on. America had Socorro pinned under her arm like a football, and she clawed at him with her free hand as the roof shot away from them, and they were thrown in a tangle on the pallets that just a second ago were the inside wall and were now the floor, the moving floor, the floor that shot like a surfboard out on the crest of the liquid mountain that was scouring the earth and blasting trees out of the ground as if they'd never been rooted. And there was the pelirrojo, the white face and flailing white arms, caught up in the mad black swirl of it like a man drowning in shit. The mountain roared, the boulders clamored, and yet they somehow stayed atop the molten flow, hurtling through the night with all the other debris. Candido heard the rush of water ahead and saw the lights of the development below them, riding high on the wave of mud that hammered the walls flat and twisted the roofs from the houses and sent him and America and little Socorro thundering into the void. Then the lights went out in unison, the far wall of the development was breached, and the two conjoined pallets were a raft in the river that the dry white wash had become, spinning out of control in the current. America was screaming, and the baby was screaming, and he could hear his own voice raised in a thin, mournful drone, and that was nothing compared to the shrieks of the uprooted trees and the nightmarish roar of the boulders rolling along beneath them. He wasn't thinking. There was no time to think, only to react. But even as he pitched into the blackness of this new river that was rushing toward completion and the old river below, he managed finally to curse the engine of all this misery in a burst of profanity that would have condemned him for all time if he hadn't been condemned already. What was it? What was it about him? All he wanted was work, and this was his fate. This was his stinking pinche luck, a violated wife and a blind baby and a crazy white man with a gun, and even that wasn't enough to satisfy an insatiable god. No, they all had to drown like rats in the bargain. There was no controlling this thing, no hope of it.
There was only the mad ride and the battering of the rocks. Candido held on to the pallet, and America held on to him. His knuckles were smashed and smashed again, but he held on because there was nothing else he could do. And then they were in the bed of the big creek, Topanga Creek, and the mountain was behind them. But this wasn't the creek Candido had drunk from and bathed in and slept behind through all those punishing months of drought. It wasn't even the creek he'd seen raging under the bridge earlier that day. It was a river, a torrent that rode right up over the bridges and the streets and everything else. There was no escaping it. The pallet bucked and spun, and finally it threw him. They hit something, something so big it was immovable, and Candido lost his grip on America and the raft at the same time. He was in the water suddenly, with nothing to hold on to, and the water was as cold as death. He went under, and it felt as if an enormous fist were pinning him down, crushing him, but he kicked out against it, slammed into a submerged log and then the jagged, tearing edge of a rock, and somehow the surface was there. "America!" he cried. "America!" In the next instant, it had him again. The furious, roiling water forced up his nostrils and rammed down his throat, the current raking him over a stony washboard, hump after hump of unyielding rock, and he saw his mother pounding the clothes back and forth in a froth of suds. He must have been 3 years old, and he knew he was going to die. "Go to the devil, mijo," and he cried out again. Then a voice spoke beside him, right in his ear. "Candido." And there was his wife. There was America holding out a hand to him. The water churned and sucked at him, throwing him forward only to jerk him away again. And where was she? There, clinging to the slick, hard surface of the washboard where it rose dizzily out of the current. He fought with all he had, and suddenly the water spat him up in his wife's arms. He was saved. He was alive. There was no sky, there was no earth, and the wind drove at them with pellets of rain and the water crashed at his feet, but he was alive and breathing and huddled in the arms of his wife, his thin, beautiful, shivering girl of a wife. It took him a moment, interpreting the humped rock beneath him with his numbed and bleeding fingers, before he understood where they were. They'd been saved by the United States Post Office, and this was the tile roof, and the building beneath them was the cut bank of the river as it swirled round the bend to the swamped bridge and the gorge beyond. "America," was all he could say, gasping it, moaning it over and over. He fell into a spasm of coughing and brought up the cocido, sour and thin, and he felt as if he were being slowly strangled. "Are you okay?" he choked. "Are you hurt?" She was sobbing. Her body and his were one, and the sob shook him till he was sobbing himself, or almost sobbing. But men didn't sob. Men endured. They worked for $3 a day, tanning hides till their fingernails fell out. They swallowed kerosene and spat out fire for tourists on street corners. They worked till there was no more work left in them. "The baby," he gasped. And he wasn't sobbing. He wasn't. "Where's the baby?" She didn't answer, and he felt the cold seep into his veins, a coldness and a weariness like nothing he'd ever known. The dark water was all around him, water as far as he could see, and he wondered if he would ever get warm again. He was beyond cursing, beyond grieving, numbed right through to the core of him. All that, yes. But when he saw the white face surge up out of the black swirl of the current and the white hand grasping at the tiles, he reached down and took hold of it. This concludes the reading of The Tortilla Curtain by T. Karagason Boyle, copyright 1995. This book was read by the author, T. Karagason Boyle. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Viking Penguin, and it was produced in 2006 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.